Good afternoon, members. The Congressional Redistricting Subcommittee will come to order. Sam, please call the roll.
Chair Saroy.
Here.
Vice Chair Tuck. Ranking Member Skidmore.
Here.
Representatives Beltran.
Here.
Benjamin. Benjamin. Brown. Fabricio.
Here.
Fetterhoff.
Here.
Fisher.
Here.
Jill Lombardo.
Here.
Harding.
Here.
Ponchowski.
Here.
Joseph.
Here.
Masullo.
Here.
Morales.
Present.
Perez.
Here.
Plakin. Silvers, excused. Toledo. Trabulsi. Trabulsi. Williamson.
Here.
Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sam. Members, a few reminders before we begin. Please silence all electronic devices, and if you wish to make public comment, please fill out a speaker form and turn it into the sergeant staff. Also, a reminder for our members and presenters today, please ensure that you turn your microphone on when you're speaking and off when you're finished. Members, welcome back to week three. So far in our committee process, we've benefited from a redistricting primer, a legislator university course on how to use the map drawing application, and then a more advanced training on the map drawing tools available to help us analyze maps in alignment with our constitutional standards. Today, we will take the next step in our efforts by reviewing the concepts that we have learned, that we've learned about, and apply them while looking at the currently enacted congressional maps. Our goal is to view more tangible examples of concepts that we've been discussing, such as compactness and using county boundaries. Seeing how these concepts can potentially interact with one another will help us understand some of the future decision points we may encounter as we deliberate maps, and it will also enable us to apply a consistent methodology for our maps as we continue to move through our process. I'd also like to take a moment to point out the same concepts we'll review today can additionally be used when members are viewing the publicly submitted maps on our website. The same concepts will help to provide a framework through which you can review a map or even help find trends that may appear throughout public submissions. Now, as we move through today's presentation, there's something for you that I'd like for all of you to keep in the back of your mind. And it's actually something that we touched on during our last meeting last week. It's very important and it warrants repeating. There is no single correct map. There is no such thing as a best map. Even as we see within the tiers of our standards, decisions must be weighed among one another with the goal of drawing a legally compliant map. And as I think we will come to appreciate more each day, Florida is a unique shape and it has a unique geography. We have an abundance of waterways and coastlines across the state. We have counties that don't always have smooth boundary lines either, as well as cities with their own unique boundary lines. As we work to create new district boundaries, all of these considerations will come into play. Now I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Pareda to present on the current congressional map. Mr. Pareda, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So as the chairman said, we're going to be looking closer at the currently enacted congressional map that was first used in the 2016 elections. Move to the next slide. So you see here, we're going to look through some examples of how we can apply the standards that we've talked about in the last several meetings and looks at some concrete examples throughout the map to kind of show you where some decision points may come up during the map and to help outline some of the concepts that were used to draw it, but also as we start to evaluate other maps or as we begin the drawing process for this coming cycle, we can apply those same concepts and to the new maps. We'll also take a little closer look at Florida's geography and some of the uniqueness that the chairman just referred to. So real quick, these are the standards, which we have shown now several times. We're going to be focusing or starting on the Tier 2 standards and going from there. Next slide. So real quick, something that we haven't really shared yet, these are some of the top-line statistics for the 2016 congressional map. Obviously, we still have 67 counties. In the congressional map, 49 of them were kept whole and not split by a district. There were 18 counties that were split. Of the 410 incorporated municipalities within the 2010 census geography when the map was drawn, 397 of them were kept whole and 13 were split. And as we've discussed previously, and as we'll talk a little bit more about today, the population deviation between the 27 congressional districts and the current map, it was plus or minus one person using the 2010 census population data. Below, you'll see the average for the three mathematical compactness scores that are primarily used in drawing the map. So that's an aggregate average of the 27 districts. And remember, those are ratios between 0 and 1. So when you look at the overall average of compactness tests for a map, it can give you a reference point on whether a particular district is above or below that particular average. So moving on real quick, where do you start when you're looking at a map? Well, one of the easiest and best places to start is simply looking at the county population totals. And for the 2016 congressional map, you can see there were seven counties that were over the ideal population of a congressional district at the time, which was 696,354 people. So those seven counties had to be split purely based on population within the state. 60 of the of the 67 counties were under the ideal population of a district. And you can see that we'll be focusing on the population equality standard in reference specifically to congressional districts, as well as the utilizing political and geographical boundary lines, which county lines fall into, and later we'll talk about incorporated municipalities. So the ideal population and the deviation for congressional districts. So the ideal population of a district is calculated by taking the state total population and dividing it by the number of districts in that particular map. So in 2010, our population was a little bit over 18.8 million people, divided by 27, comes out to that number of 696,345. You can see in now the 2020 census population numbers, we have 21,538,187 people divided by now 28 congressional districts, comes up with our new ideal population of 769,221 people. Now, with congressional districts, there is that population equality of plus or minus one standard. Legislative districts have a different standard that's usually considered plus about 10%, which is plus or minus 5%. That's generally the accepted range where the burden of proof will shift. So if things are under 10%, it's generally considered acceptable when talking about state legislative lines. Over that, it's up to the map drawers to prove that they had to deviate more than 10% to achieve whatever the state goals happened to be at the time. But for congressional districts, the standard of plus or minus one person, which has become known as the one vote, one person, one vote principle, that was established in 1964 with the Westerby versus Sanders case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Since then, that has been the standard that has been generally accepted for the drawing of congressional districts nationwide. Now, there have been some exceptions made to that particular standard throughout the decades. As you'll learn with most things with redistricting, there's usually a set standard and exceptions that can be made throughout it in different specific circumstances. The most recent of which is in West Virginia, where in the Tenet versus Jefferson County, West Virginia, there was a Supreme Court case where the Supreme Court allowed a slight deviation in West Virginia's congressional districts. The state was able to keep all their counties whole within the state of West Virginia. All three of their congressional districts followed this principle, and that specific exception that the Supreme Court made for West Virginia was because the state was able to apply that principle statewide to all three of their congressional districts. To this point, the Supreme Court has not put in a minimum standard that is an allowable deviation for congressional districts called the de minimis standard. No such standard exists for congressional districts, and any exception that has been made throughout the decades for deviations in population for congressional districts are usually very specific to that state, to that district, and to that redistricting cycle. So just because West Virginia had that exception made last time doesn't mean it will be allowed to have that same exception made in the future. Florida has never deviated from that plus or minus one person standard since the principle was put into effect. And that's it for that slide. So now we're going to move on to the principle of keeping counties whole. So we looked briefly before at the total population counts throughout the map and the counties that could be kept whole or not kept whole. So that can be looked at in two different ways, and we'll talk about them both. The first is keeping counties whole. So 60 counties were too small to fit a congressional district into, so they could, in theory, be kept whole by adding the populations of those counties together with other whole counties or other parts of a county to create an entire district. Some examples of that are Congressional District 1 and Congressional District 3. So you can see, since we're using the principle of keeping counties whole in the panhandle, it's generally an easy place to come up with an example like this, because you have to start in Escambia County. You can't go north into Alabama, you can't go into the Gulf, and you can't go west. So you have to just add whole counties together until you achieve the population of a congressional district. So District 1 is the populations of Escambia County, Santa Rosa, Okaloosa, and Walton counties. And then there is a county split made in Holmes County to achieve equal population with a congressional district. And the decision was made to do that all within one county rather than putting a split into two counties and dividing that population up. With Congressional District 3, you can see that five-county combination of Union, Bradford, Clay, Alachua, and Putnam counties were combined together with the populations, some population in Marion County, including the entire incorporated municipality boundary of the city of Ocala. That's the kind of bump at the bottom of the district. So these are both examples of keeping counties whole and combining them with a portion of another county to achieve equal population in a congressional district. So the kind of flip side of that keeping counties whole is keeping districts wholly within a county. So in a congressional district context, looking at the 2010 population, there were seven counties that were too big to be kept whole. So where it was feasible, districts were kept within those counties. If you look throughout the map, you can see that in five of those seven counties. This is an example in Orange County. Congressional District 10 was kept wholly within Orange County. And that is an example of Orange County being too big for one congressional district, so this was an opportunity to keep a district entirely within the county. You can see here there's two examples side by side in Hillsborough County and Pinellas County. If you look at Congressional District 13 and Congressional District 14, both are wholly within their respective counties. Congressional District 13 is also a good example to look at, kind of like with the panhandle, where if you want to try to minimize county splits, keep districts wholly within county, when looking at a county like Pinellas County, which is almost entirely a peninsula, you have to start at the bottom and work your way up. Otherwise, you'll end up with a district that's in the middle and some population that's on the bottom that would then have to be connected across whatever body of water that peninsula is attached to get the remaining portion of the population. So in this particular case, it was started in the south and worked its way north. It actually did end up splitting the city of Clearwater, but because congressional districts have to achieve that population equality, that was just a mathematical decision as you work your way up and achieve that equal population. They mathematically had to split the city of Clearwater. In Congressional District 14, the city of Tampa was actually kept wholly within that district. That actually accounts for the kind of diamond-shaped flag coming off the top of Congressional District 4. That actually follows the municipal lines of the city of Tampa. So looking real quick in our current situation. So if we look at the county population totals using the 2020 census data, you can see that it's actually the same seven counties that are over the new ideal population of a congressional district, which is 769,221 people. So we're going to move past counties and move on to the other part of political boundaries when we start in map drawing context. This is actually a map of Florida's 412 incorporated municipalities throughout the state. It's kind of a big statewide image, and you can kind of see how it all breaks down. You can also get a pretty good sense for how much of the state is within an incorporated municipality and how much of the state is not. But where we can, we do try to utilize these boundary lines, though maybe not as often as county lines, and we'll get into some examples of why Florida municipalities present different challenges when drawing a map or when evaluating a map. So here's kind of a zoomed in look. The next couple slides are kind of more zoomed in of that statewide image, so you can kind of get a better sense of the area within counties that are incorporated municipalities and how much of our state is not incorporated. Down in Central Florida, and then the next slide you can see in South Florida. So you can see in South Florida a little bit more of the population is condensed to the coastlines and a little bit more incorporated municipalities, but there's still a lot of area in between that's not. It should be noted that the area in pink that we've been looking at, those are the 412 incorporated municipalities. The Census Bureau does have another designation called census-designated places and other types of places. There's 955 of them in the state of Florida, but we only look at the incorporated municipalities because they have legally defined boundaries by their local governments. Census-designated places and other places of that nature don't have a legally defined boundary that we can use for the purpose of redistricting. So looking in the context of that ideal population for a congressional district, there's actually only one incorporated municipality that is more than that 769,221 person number that you'll hear a lot here in this particular committee. That is the city of Jacksonville. So incorporated municipal lines actually present interesting challenges when you're looking at a map. Here's an example of the city of Davie, Southwest Ranches, and Pembroke Pines in Broward County. And you can see that those three cities essentially intertwine with each other. There are discontiguous portions of each of those cities. There's holes within the cities. So in order to keep one of those cities whole, you might have to split another or have to keep all three of them together in the same district. Actually, in the current congressional map, Congressional District 23 actually does keep all three of them together within a single house or a single congressional district, but that may not be possible based on how the math breaks down in this current decade. But these are just an example of kind of the uniqueness of Florida municipal boundary lines that we have to take into account. So it may not be possible to keep every city whole just based on their geography. Here's another example of that in Volusia County, where you can see the city of Edgewater and New Smyrna Beach have a lot of very small discontiguous portions of their municipal lines. Just another example showing how irregular some of those boundary lines can be and how much of the other territory in between that we would have to account for. And finally, this is another example. This is the city of Northport, which is actually split by the Myakka River. So there's actually two completely separate parts of that city, but they're all the city of Northport. Interestingly enough, kind of a Florida fun fact, we actually do have four municipalities in the state based on the 2020 census geography that actually cross county lines. So the city of Longboat Key is both in Manatee and Sarasota counties. Marineland is in Flagler and St. John's County. Flagler Beach is in Flagler and Volusia County, and Fanning Springs is split between Gilchrist and Levy County. So this is, just presents another example in Florida's uniqueness where if we choose to keep particular counties whole, it may split one of these cities. Or if we have to keep those two cities or those two counties together in order to keep the city whole, or maybe parts of the county together, to keep the cities whole. So that's just another interesting interesting nugget of Florida's geography. So this is an example of a district where there was an effort made to keep a city whole. If you look at Congressional District 15, the boundary between 15 and 11, there appears to be this kind of bump on top of Congressional District 15. That bump was actually done so in the context of the 2010 geography to keep the city of Groveland whole within a particular congressional district, because the city itself divides the highway that kind of goes right through this Lake County. And if you see the next slide, it kind of is a zoomed-in version of that. So you can kind of see that's the city of Groveland. Now, what's interesting about this is that this is also an example of how city boundaries can actually change decade from decade. The Census Bureau, in between the decades, does do an effort to update and improve its block lines and its municipal lines that it has on file. But cities also go through more changes than county lines do typically throughout the decade. So you can see here, this is the current boundary of the city of Groveland and how it has actually expanded beyond the bump that was drawn in to allow for the city of Groveland. But in the 2010 municipal line geographies, the city of Groveland was kept whole within Congressional District 15. So here is an example of using waterways, moving more into the geographic boundaries that congressional districts and other districts can use throughout throughout the state of Florida. This is an example of between Congressional District 3 and 4, where actually the county line, which is a political geography, also corresponds with the actual physical geography of the river, the St. John's River, that happens to be right there. If you zoom in to the next slide, you can see a more zoomed-in version of that. So unlike some states out west that are mostly rectangular in shape and have square county lines, because we have so much water in our state, we have so much uniqueness to our geography, even our county lines can have squiggly shapes to them. And when we try to keep counties whole and abide by those constitutional standards, it's going to lend itself to some odd-shaped lines or odd-shaped geography throughout it. This is an example of that. This is actually an example of using some more geographic boundaries that don't happen to coincide with a county line. If you look at Congressional District 17 and Congressional District 9, you see this boundary line right there that mostly divides those two districts, uses mostly municipal boundaries in addition to major roadways and railways. And on this next slide here, you can see the pink areas that are highlighted. Those are actually the major roads, kind of county roads that are in Polk County. That green section, that is a railway that runs through there. And the highlighted yellow portion at the top is the city of Frostproof. So that boundary between those two districts utilizes all of those boundaries. This is an example, again, of using waterways, but waterways that don't happen to coincide with a county line. So here you see the Alafia River, which divides Congressional District 15 and Congressional District 16 in Hillsborough County. And if you move to the next slide there, you can see the division there. If I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, my apologies. But here you can see that throughout the entirety of those two districts within Hillsborough County, the river is the boundary line there. It does not deviate off that entirely. This is another example, the Suwannee River, which also happens to coincide with county lines throughout the Big Bend of Florida. So you can see Hamilton County, Columbia County, Suwannee County, Lafayette County, Gilchrist County, Levy County, and a few others use the Suwannee River along their county lines respectively. And the Suwannee River is an older river. It has a lot of bends and turns. So if you zoom in on the next slide, you'll see that if we utilize those county boundaries in that river, you're going to have a lot of little jagged edges, which might be negatively impacted on mathematical compactness tests. So waterways are something else that we have to use here in Florida a lot, when a lot of unique geography here. One of the best examples is Lake Okeechobee, which actually borders five counties, Okeechobee County, Martin County, Palm Beach County, Hendry County, and Glades County all share some of the shore of Lake Okeechobee. The way the Census Bureau divides Lake Okeechobee, or these big lake or other water bodies that exist in the map, is that it finds a point in the geographic center of the lake and then draws the counties out to the center of that point back to its shoreline. That creates a lot of jagged points that you could see within most of the maps that we have now currently. The best example is the Hendry County, kind of on the bottom, with that little tiny point that goes right up at the top. It's a very skinny little point. That's just part of some of the uniqueness of our county boundaries that we have to account for when we're drawing a map. So you might see some of those points throughout district maps, but those are simply following the county line. Water blocks is another thing that we have here, is we have coastline along most of our state. The coastline along the east coast of Florida goes out 3 miles. On the Gulf side, it actually goes out 9 miles, which is the territorial waters of the state of Florida. That was a Supreme Court ruling in 1960, and actually this the Census Bureau just updated those boundary lines back in 2019 in their geographic files. So these blocks can be difficult to work with. You can see here the blue line going across. That's the county line between Collier and Lee County. So if we were to keep Collier County and Lee County whole in a particular map but on separate districts, it's going to naturally create a flag sticking off of Collier County. That's just part of Florida's geography that we have to deal with. The Florida Everglades is another interesting, unique part of our geography in that it has a lot of very large, oddly shaped blocks and generally very low population, if any population at all. But those are all blocks that have to be included into some district somewhere and that we have to account for. This is an example of compactus, another Tier 2 standard. District 3 is the district within the congressional MAC that map that scores the highest actually in all three mathematical compactness scores. You can see it is generally shaped like a circle, so that's very good for the REOC test. It also doesn't have a lot of jagged edges and points, which score well in convex hull. And even though it does follow the river there a little bit in St. John's County, there's not a little tiny squiggles and jagged lines following other like the Suwannee River, so it scores pretty well with Paulsby Popper. So this is one of the most compact mathematical districts within the map, but that's when you're looking at evaluating compactness. Beyond the visual compactness, which we all can kind of see whether or not a district we think looks compact or not, the mathematical tests give us a sense of where that district is going to perform, and you can compare that to the average in the state map that we looked at the beginning, to determine whether or not that district may fall kind of on the upper end or the lower end of all the districts within the map. Another kind of Florida fun fact is that we are one of 6 states that actually have valid non-contiguous territory. So one of our Tier 1 standards is contiguous territory, and although you have to draw your districts entirely, there will always be one point in Monroe County that is actually non-contiguous from the other, but that is expected and okay. The other states that have non-contiguous territory are New York, Rhode Island, Hawaii, Alaska, and one other, and Washington State. Oh, and Rhode Island, I'm sorry. Not Washington State, Rhode Island. And that's it, Chair.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Pareda, for the presentation. Members, do we have any questions? Any questions on today's presentation? Ranking Member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions that I wanted to raise. One is, on the Senate side, we heard from Chair Rodriguez that the intention is to not begin with the existing districts or the existing district map. And I'm curious as to what the position of this committee and the House is in terms of the beginning point.
Thank you very much, Ranking Member, for the good question. You know, I think it's important for members to understand, and today's exercise is a part of this, we are tasked with drawing 28 new congressional districts. So we're going to look at the information that the Census provided us. We are in the process now of continuing to build out this foundational knowledge examining the current map and the different features involved and how the tiers apply is a part of that process. But in terms of how we move forward, our committee is tasked with drawing 28 new congressional districts. Now, that's not to say that the work product that we reach doesn't in some ways look very similar to the map that we operate under now. And as we learned today, there are a lot of features in our state, rivers, railroads, major highways, county boundaries, municipal boundaries. These are things that have not changed necessarily over time. So we're going to take the new census data that we have, we're going to apply it to these standards, and we're going to come up with 28 new congressional districts.
Follow up?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comment would be that we know that the court has approved the existing map and those lines, and so it would be a good starting point in terms of being able to meet constitutional muster and court and pass the court process. So we would be interested in knowing how that beginning point is going to start.
Thank you very much, Ranking Member, for your comments. You know, I think we have seen that as we've been moving through this education process that the entire committee has been going through. We've examined the tiers. We've certainly talked about the court precedent. And I think that all of that should be foremost in our minds as we begin our deliberations eventually on our work product. So I thank you for raising those good points.
Other questions?
Got to leave that on. Other questions, members? Representative Joseph, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not directly to the presentation. It was just a follow-up on an outstanding question from the last committee meeting we had. At which I asked if there was going to be, outside of the website, any means contemplated for public participation. So, and I know you said you were going to talk to somebody, I think Chair Leak, but I don't remember who you said you were going to talk to. I was just trying to see if there was any update.
Thank you, Representative Joseph, for the question. You know, while I will say that that is certainly part of the conversation, we're up against some time constraints now, and we have a website that has a tremendous amount of capability. The residents of our state can submit their own proposals for maps. They can submit comments to us through that website. Just like the budget or any other bill that this legislature takes up, there's the opportunity for members of the public to provide testimony to us here at the Capitol. We haven't had anybody take us up on that offer yet. Hopefully there's some members of the public here today that would like to speak with us and share their views. But the website does have tremendous capability, both in terms of submission of proposals and comments. And I encourage all Floridians to make good use of that tool. Representative Joseph, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I understand and appreciate the website, the reality is a lot of people do not necessarily have access to a website or to the internet, period, especially and particularly in rural and certain parts of urban areas, that even though the internet exists there, like they themselves don't have the internet at their house. And that's something that we saw, particularly in the pandemic, that we had to address with, like, children, for example, who didn't have access, so we got them access. I guess what I'm saying is, I hear what you're saying about the bills, but the redistricting process, I would posit, is much more than just a run-of-the-mill bill. And it would be really good if we could figure out a way to contemplate some kind of, if not public hardcore participation, at least some kind of interaction or education or some kind of component where people who may not have access to a website might be able to participate in this process, even if it's just to let them know what's going on. And this is just a request, but it would be good. Like, I understand what you're saying with the website, no problem with the website. Just reiterating the request that I believe you said you were going to talk to Chair Leak or somebody to see what we could do about it. So just in case that fell by the wayside, I'm just bringing it back up again. Please. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Joseph. I hear you. We will continue those conversations, and I'll keep you posted. I do appreciate you bringing it up. Members, other questions? All right, we'll go to Representative Masullo, and then to the ranking member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very good presentation, Mr. Porita. Is there any legal precedence to prioritize any of those issues that you said tried to keep whole, like counties, cities, et cetera, when we're actually reviewing these maps?
Mr. Prater, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. No, so within the context of them all being on the same tier, so all political, geographical boundaries, they're all on the same tier of consideration. So one is not put before the other, though I will say that county boundaries, the Supreme Court have said, has relied on more. They tend to change less than even municipal lines, and they tend to be more recognizable. And the Supreme Court has erred to those. But no, within the one tier, there shouldn't be a priority made over any other.
Representative Masullo, you're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then we won't prioritize them over any other population area, then, correct or not?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure if I understand the question.
As we look to draw these maps, these new maps for these 28 new congressional districts for our state, will we prioritize the county lines individually above any other aspect of geography?
We will prioritize them like the Supreme Court has suggested. So all the political and geographical boundary lines will all be considered among the same. And when you're drawing districts, it's all a balancing of all of those standards, particularly the ones along the same tier.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Ranking member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments at this point, if that's appropriate. Just reiterating again the concern that congressional and legislative committees meet at the same time, thereby limiting the ability for people who are interested in both processes to be able to participate fully. I know it's been raised, but just again making the point. Also a request, if possible, I know things move fast and furiously, but the lateness of the packet that we received for today's meeting was difficult for us to, you know, sort of dive into. As it gets a little more complicated, that's going to be more difficult, and obviously as it gets a little more complicated, it might get even later. So just giving us an opportunity to be able to review the packet in advance. And my last comment is in regard to what I would refer to as prison gerrymandering and a request or a question as to how the House is going to approach that subject. I know that other states, 12 other states, I believe, apply a correctness and either count the person back at their last known address they're relocated to where they actually should be counted, thereby changing and correcting the counts. If you look at a map of the prisons, I think there are 108, prison facilities, not counting, you know, the federal, which we don't have accurate counts of, but certainly we know where all the state prison inmates are. And that skews the counts in different districts, right, and changes the numbers. And so just as a point of interest for our caucus, where other states have made the change to count the folks where they live or lived, where they're going to go back to after they complete their incarceration, and curious as to what the process in the House might be. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Ranking Member, for your comments. I will look into the issue of when the materials are available to members. On the issue related to where inmates are counted, the Census Bureau counts the inmates where they reside on census day. Pursuant to Florida law, we do not manipulate the census data when it arrives. So the data that we are given is the data that we're going to use for this process. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That understand that that's a choice that we are making, but that it is not the rule, and understanding that prisons do close. And I think three prisons have closed in the state of Florida this year. And so I think that there is opportunity for the state to, or the House to make the decision, and that it is not a mandate in any way that we cannot count them where they live or will live.
Thank you very much, Ranking Member. And I hear what you're saying, and I'd point out that college dormitories, nursing home, assisted living facilities are treated in the same respect. So, you know, that's similar in terms of how they're treated with the collection of that data on Census Day, where those folks reside. Members, any other questions? All right. Thank you very much for your good questions, members. Members of the audience, do we have any public speakers to provide testimony with us today? Do we have any comment cards? All right. Well, members, I want to thank you once again for your time this afternoon, and I want to thank you for your comments. Ranking Member, as always, thank you for your comments and your input as well. Members, I hope you found today's exercise to be another step in understanding our constitutional standards, as well as a little more about our great state, some Florida fun facts as well. And I look forward to future meetings where we will dive into tier one of our constitutional standards. That concludes our meeting agenda for today. Representative Tribolsi moves that we rise without objection. Thank you.